Hey everyone, it's Angela Stevens with the podcast Refocus with Angela. Thank you so much for joining us today. I am so delighted to introduce you to my guest. Many of you may know him because he's quite the social icon. He's on social media everywhere, but he's actually a digital futurist and a keynote speaker. And he's got some really incredible background in the cybersecurity space. And we're going to touch on that, but we're going to talk to him about how he focuses. So Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Absolutely. So talk to us a little bit about who you are and what you do, because I know you're working on some really exciting things and I want to get into that. But if somebody didn't know you, how would they find you and what do they know about you?
Yeah, so I love that. So I think first and foremost, the greatest job I have is I'm a girl dad to three little girls, 11, 10, and 9 years old. I am ADHD superpowered. I was diagnosed at 31, so I'm now 40. So about 9 years ago, I was diagnosed. And about 24 months ago, my middle daughter was diagnosed ADHD and dyslexia as well. So part of integrated into my journey. I'm a digital futurist keynote speaker. So I speak at about 60 events a year. I've had the luxury of traveling to 76 countries, goal of hopefully reaching 100 countries by the time I turn 45. So that's kind of the next goal on there. And for me, I like to say I worked in cybersecurity for 9 years for the U.S. government here at the Pentagon, traveled 3 trips to Iraq, 2 to Afghanistan, been to every country in the Middle East. And really my focus then was, I like to say, I translated the geek speak around cybersecurity and collaboration tools. Mm-hmm. And I kind of fell into a really interesting position where I was getting hired or I was speaking at events for the government as well as the next couple of companies I worked for in what was termed as like cross-generational communication, which just really meant they wanted to know how to hire and talk to millennials. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a pager wearing millennial, which just means I was born in 1981, which is the year that the millennial generation is the cutoff. So I'm like on the edge.
I was
going to
say, what are you? Are you a millennial?
I'm okay. A millennial, but I'm like literally on the cut. And so I say pager wearing millennial because I always referred to that I owned a pager because there was a time that I would get introduced and they would say like, Brian was, he's a millennial born with an iPhone and on Facebook. But yet, when I grew up, I didn't have an iPhone. When I graduated college, I gave up my EDU address and I couldn't actually get on Facebook because I was actually, my younger brothers were able to get on there. But so for me, it was always positioning like, hey, I'm kind of the older generation or the older segment of millennials. And so I've done, I worked for the government for 9 years. I did 2 years at a really exciting startup out of Phoenix, Arizona, in the cloud computing space. It was actually my dream job, which was a technology evangelist was really my dream job going up in college. And it was modeled after what Guy Kawasaki did at Apple. So it was creating this idea where I reported to the CEO, I had a dotted line to the CIO and a dotted line to the CMO. And really my job was not to sell, not to market, was really to help the clients, our partners, re-examine the role of technology. And in a way, most of the time, I actually help them use less technology and understand where technology and people kind of work together. And so now for the last 7 years, doing it as a speaker, I get to speak at such a wide variety of companies and brands, which is really exciting for me, and really focused on helping people shift their mindset to saying, technology isn't going to replace what we do as humans. It's not something that's going to solve all of our problems. But if we integrate technology correctly, we're going to be able to focus more on the things that we love to do, as humans. And so that's really where I'm at now. It's, I host a couple of podcasts. I do a lot on the social media space around live video, the power of social audio. And most recently, I'm really focused on this idea of the creator economy and how can we shift our focus so that we can understand new ways to monetize the things that we love doing. So like my current like passion is helping those that have something that they're passionate about that maybe was a side hustle. Maybe they were told you could never do that because how are you going to make money? I'm helping.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really focused on like that cryptocurrency, NFT, digital space on how do we use some of these technologies to re-examine the way that we make money online. So that's kind of where I'm at today.
Oh, that's great. And I want to break that down a little bit because I've got a lot of questions around that. So you talk to a lot of different companies, but you talk to about the new generation and what they're doing. And we see a lot that individuals from the younger generation don't want to do the corporate jobs. They don't want the traditional jobs. They want that different kind of job out there. First of all, do you see that too? And second of all, if you're a company business owner, what do you do about that? How do you get them re-engaged?
So, you know, it's a really interesting space we're in right now, because I think as a whole, and we could definitely say over the last 24 months, thanks to the pandemic, I think almost all of us are reexamining what does work actually mean for us? How do we show up for work, right? I started back in 2013 speaking about this idea of shrinking the distance between what we do offline and what we do online. I've never believed in like the online versus offline. It's more of like, hey, this is how we live and we have to integrate it. And I actually think if we look at the younger generation, especially those under the age of 35 today, I think it's less about they don't want to work for corporate, but more about the fact that they want to have impact. They want to understand their own individual impact. And they also want to be able to have the freedom, the responsibility to design their work life around their life. And I would probably argue every generation has wanted that, right? Every generation since forever has always wanted.
Right. We were just raised, right? A certain way to think a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we were also raised to, you know, in many ways, not to question the 9-to-5, not to question, you know, and I don't believe, you know, I think there, and this is a big sticking point for me, like, I don't believe everyone should become an entrepreneur. Actually, most of the time, my friends, which is, you know, people that I coach, I actually steer a lot of people away from entrepreneurship, not because I don't believe in the power of entrepreneurship. I've been doing it for 7 years now, but I believe a lot of times there's a falsehood of why we want to become an entrepreneur. Yeah. And we don't understand A, what's all involved in being an entrepreneur, and B, what we really want can be designed for us in the corporate world. It just has to be that right alignment, right? And I think that to me is exciting. You know, we're moving towards what I believe we are, you know, everything from, you know, why do people want to work from home and can they be productive? Well, we kind of forced into that for the last 24 months. And a lot of companies now are realizing, why are we forcing people to come in 5 days a week for 8 hours a day when we can have them come in 2 or 3 days a week? And I think this is that like interesting balance of where, how do we, you know, empower freedom, empower people to have impact while also understanding like we have to have these different things at work. And I think, especially the younger generation today, hyper loyal. So like the idea that like, oh, they job hop. Part of the reason they job hop is because they have more information about what's going on around the world and around other companies than we've ever had before, right? I think that's something we have to recognize. Like, I mean, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you know, and I remember like the first time I left the state, like I was like the first of my family that had left the state. And I went to my first trip to Iraq and Afghanistan. I came back and the idea of like me seeing the world was my entire family had never really left the state of Pennsylvania other than like a vacation. And today's generation, you know, even my daughters, my oldest, my 11-year-old, you know, she's Zoomed with one of my good friends and business partners in Australia, and she can tell you what Vegemite is. She knows, you know, what things are going on in Australia. So I think there's a beauty in having more information, more data, more access. And in many ways, that means today's generation isn't as compliant to say, hey, I'm stuck in this job, or hey, this is the best I can do. A lot of it is, hey, I'm doing great things here and there's better opportunities, but this is a generation that is hyper loyal.
Absolutely. And, you know, a case in point, my son, who is a co-founder of our company, which is Refocus, the creative office, and he came up with our first suite of products. And so, you know, if you are a parent or a company owner, if you see a talent, embrace it, let them talk to you. I always say, you know, from my search for my own, when I interview people, I always say, go talk to the employer. If you have an idea, because maybe you're in a department that you're feeling stifled or you're not growing, but maybe they don't know that, hey, you have an experience writing a press release or you have experience speaking. They don't know that if you don't tell them. So you kind of have to educate the employer. And now a word from our sponsor. In today's world, employees expect health benefits from their employer. Organizations of all sizes need affordable, easy to manage health benefits to recruit and retain top talent. That's where PeopleKeep comes in to save the day. PeopleKeep is the number one rated HRA administration software for small to medium sized organizations. Thousands of employers trust PeopleKeep to help them reimburse employees tax-free for healthcare expenses, empowering employees to choose the products and services they actually want. When using an HRA with PeopleKeep, you have complete control over your costs by choosing allowance amounts that fit within your budget. Plus, administering your benefit is hassle-free. Most customers only need 5 minutes a month to administer their benefit. The PeopleKeep software and award-winning customer support team do all the heavy lifting to keep your benefit compliant and your employees happy. All you have to do is reimburse your employees through payroll. Ready to learn more? Visit peoplekeep.com/refocus to schedule a call with a personalized benefits advisor today. One other thing I wanted to ask you, I'm curious when you said I steer people away from entrepreneurism, is it because of the financing and, you know, doing the books and the legal part of it, or what is it that's the dream that does not become the dream?
Well, I think part of, you know, becoming, I mean, I think the all-encompassing role of an entrepreneur is massive, right? And I have like a unique experience because I worked 9 years for one of the largest government contractors in the world. I worked at a startup that when I got hired, I was employee 256, which the reason I remember that is we got like this rugby jersey that had our number on it, and 256 is a computer number. And so I worked there for 2 years and 10 days. We had 612 employees when I left. We were hiring 12 new hires a week. That was part of my team. And I worked at the government, worked at the startup, and now I've been an entrepreneur for 7 years. So interestingly enough for me, I loved all three jobs that I had. I absolutely mm-hmm. loved the government contractor yeah. I worked for, loved the startup I worked for. But I believe the skill set, the knowledge, I believe the idea that like I have the freedom to work how I want is oftentimes like what we hear about, you know, as an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. But then we hear things like, you know, you don't have to work for the man or the woman. And then we also caveat with like, you work, you know, 60 hours a week, so you don't have to work 40 hours a week for someone else. Well, I know a lot of people that are very dedicated with, you know, like what they love to do, but they don't want to work 60 hours a week, right? They want to do something they love, but they don't want to have all that on their shoulder. So they don't want to have all that pressure. And this includes everything from hiring people to, you know, the role of business development, the idea of scaling. And I think there's also something beautiful about what a brand and a corporate structure can offer a lot of people in a standpoint of, and I don't like the idea of it just being security, right? Because I remember that was my dad all the time, which is funny because my dad was an entrepreneur.
Work at the post office 30 yeah. years, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which is like the way that it was. Like my grandfather graduated from Westinghouse. It was the first job he got. It was the job he graduated. But my dad was a candy salesman, and he ended up becoming the CEO and founder of a large peanut brittle company that he sold. But my dad was an entrepreneur, but in his mind, he never really was. He always looked at it as like, there in that space, there really was no like big company other than the ones that he was helping create. But he instilled in my brothers and I, like, go work for someone that has a 401k, work with someone that has job security. Well, I don't look at corporate or a brand as job security today, right? I think we have like a falsehood where, you know, people are willing to lay off people. You know, we like things weren't going good, but I do look at a lot of the parameters of like, how do you have a great team around you? How do we truly innovate? Like, I believe the foundation of innovation is through collaboration. And oftentimes as an entrepreneur, being able to empower that collaboration is a long stretch game to actually get to a spot where you can do, you know, have that, you know, bandwidth to do that. And in a corporate world, you can often do that from the jump. And so I think that's part of why I kind of sometimes steer people away from entrepreneurship, but also because I believe becoming an entrepreneur takes a certain skill set and a certain dedication and understanding.
You have to be all in. Everything.
You have to roll with, you know, like the feeling of, you know, wanting to throw up one day at, you know, 11 a.m. because you lost a client or something didn't go well. And then at 4 o'clock, right, you get, you know, an invoice paid early and you're excited. And then you wake up in the middle of the night and you have like the hot sweats because you're afraid something's, you know, like that roller coaster.
Yeah. You know, really tough. I have to just say before we started this interview today, I was explaining to Brian that our company got involved into an email phishing scam. We lost $25,000 to Hong Kong. And, you know, that could have put a lot of people out of business, right?
Sure.
We tried to get help from a lot of different sources. We didn't. And so finally, I just went back to my staff and I said, look, it's 25,000. It's not 25 million. Let's keep our eye on the ball and let's focus. Let's keep going and look at the bigger picture. And we never looked back. So, you know, you have those hits in business as well. And so, you know, we've learned from a lot of different mistakes. So mistakes can actually build you. When the pandemic hit, for us, we were shipping our products through Amazon, which we still do, but we were not an essential item. Therefore, overnight, we had to create our own shipping warehouse. We had to figure that all out. So you're exactly right. And so there's a lot of companies right now that are hiring too, that would love, if you would come to them and say, hey, could I do this? Or could I have a shot at this? They would probably be very open more now than ever, you know? So,
for sure.
So I've got a question about focusing for you. So you speak, first of all, what has been, out of all of these different countries and these events that you've spoke at, what's been the most interesting and the most impactful speech that you gave to a company?
Ooh, I don't think I've been asked that question. So the interesting one was I actually spoke at a pet influencer company. It was called Bark World. There was more dogs in the audience than there were people. The average revenue generation of the influencers in the room was over $1 million per person. in the pet influencer space. Yeah. And at the time I was confusing. Now thinking about it in the fact that we love our pets.
That's a huge business market. Because people look at their pets like they are their children, especially if they do not have children or if they're empty nesters. Those animals are so fortunate because they become like pet children to the parents.
And when it comes to deciding what food to buy or what products to work, you're going to trust others who love their animals more so than a brand or a marketing website or an advertisement in pet, yes, in the pet space. So that audience was so interesting for me because it was, I've worked a lot as an influencer myself now, 7 years, you know, generating six figures of income just off of influencer work. And I've done it in like kind of the B2B tech space, the not sexy space of influencer work. But like that was a very interesting, shift for me. Also, I like to joke that like, you know, the dogs in the audience made better eye contact and did not get on their phone while I was talking. So for me, that was a great
Even the Apple Watches. Have you noticed how people they pull them up and you think, okay, wait, am I interrupting you? Do you need to go somewhere? I mean, I always tell people when they're interviewing, I'm always like, just take that watch off because it is so distracting. And then it makes the other person feel uncomfortable.
That's true. They're very true. So yeah. And so that would be the most interesting, the most impactful, I would say the most impactful was, I had an opportunity to speak in Dubai to entrepreneurs, and it was about 12,000 entrepreneurs in the audience. It was back in 2015. And the Middle East is my favorite region in the world that I've ever traveled to. My favorite country of 76 is a small country called Bahrain, named Bahrain. It's a small island off of the coast of Saudi Arabia. Amazing, beautiful people. I just love the culture there. I've had the opportunity to travel there over a dozen times. And so when I was in Dubai as a white male American speaker coming to that country and really being able to listen, I got to spend 3 days before I got on stage with the community, got to see what they're doing in the entrepreneur space, empowering some of these amazing, talented people that to not only reinvent the way they look at business, but reinvent the way they have conversations. The reason that that event stands out as most impactful was through the conversation, I started to realize that my talk wasn't going to resonate as much as I thought it was going to, because I was really focused on this idea of what they really wanted me to hire and talk to them about, how do they market better as an entrepreneur. And I have a talk called Think Like a Fan. My last name is Fanzo, so it kind of works really nice. And it's about, it's about how do you put yourself in the shoes of your audience and market to them in that way. But throughout that 3 days, so much of the conversation came back to the mental health element of entrepreneurship. And I didn't have a talk on my program around ADHD or mental health, but I was very vocal, back in 2013, I started really being openly transparent with my journey and a lot of things I was going through. And I went to the board that had hired me, and this was a large, long hiring process. They had spent, it was like almost a year to get me there and then do all these things. And I went to them and said, hey, I want to shift what I want to talk about. And I really want to help people look at the mindset required to live in this social media space and this tech space. And I will tell you, this is 2015, long before mental health as like an okay topic to talk about in that arena. I think in the last 3 years, it's definitely shifted. And when I was talking to the group that had hired me, they said the number of people that had come to them over the 3 days talking about the things that I had talked to them, they pretty much just said, Brian, we trust you. Whatever you want to talk about, you have 60 minutes in front of the audience. And I redesigned kind of a talk. And interestingly enough, I never gave that talk again. It was the only time I actually gave it. But it was built on this idea of where really what I do today is now was actually born back then in 2015. And being able to talk to people about, the importance of self-care, understanding self-awareness, the role of, ADHD in my life, and even how I kind of own it as my own superpower, but I'm also not afraid to discuss how it impacts every minute of my life.
And anyone who has ADHD or ADD, once they're focused, they can be brilliant.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And that's part of my conversation on ADHD, especially, has always been, it's not that we can't focus. We struggle regulating our focus, right? And I think that's such a difference. Like the name of ADHD, probably was the branding of ADHD was never, in my opinion, done very well, because this idea of, people say like, oh, ADHD is squirrel, you can't pay attention. And I'm like, no, I am a hyper-focus. Like I'll work all night, knock things out. But I will say the reason I think of that as most impactful is still to this day. So 6 years later, I still get messages probably once a month from people that were part of that event or in that audience that are saying things like, Brian, I didn't become an entrepreneur. It didn't work out for me. I'm now working at this company in the UK or wherever it may be, but I have a handle and a way to have a conversation with my bosses around my
mental
health.
That is huge. Like and when they say that, do they go to HR or do they go to the company owner or their department manager? What do you recommend in those type of situations?
So I think for me, like, I think a lot of it is per person, right? I'm a big believer in transparency, but I'm a big believer in deciding your own transparency, right? I think there's a difference between transparency and oversharing. And those of us with ADHD have a tendency to overshare in many avenues, many places, because for us, it's allowing to lift the burden that we've kind of always grown up, especially if you were adult diagnosed. We have, you know, for me, 31 years of my life, I felt like I was broken. Even as successful as I was in my career, struggled through high school and college, barely got into college. And for
me, probably like many, got more no's than yeses, right?
Even when I got a yes, it was usually caveated with, imagine if you had applied yourself, Brian, or imagine if you would just could do some of the things that everyone else is doing. And I will say, like, you know, I was the oldest of three boys. Both of my younger brothers, straight A students, amazing at what they did. I was a kid that, you know, I had perfect attendance in high school and college, loved school, not good at school. Like, and now knowing that a lot of the things that we were forced to do were not built for those that were neurodiverse, right? They have a neurotypical, right, you know, structure. And for me, like, even, you know, my career, you know, the story of how I even started working in the government, how that all happened, was 6 months into my job. I was an overnight help desk support for a tech inside of the government. And the boss came in and on a Friday and said, raise your hand here if you're willing to go to Korea on Monday to teach our course. And I happened to have my hand up first. And he was like, do you have a passport? And I was like, no, but I've been on a cruise in the Caribbean. So the boss said, hey, Brian, are you sure that you can actually, you know, deliver and teach this course when you get there into Korea? And I said, I don't know it today, but I can promise you when I land on the ground, I'll know enough to teach the course. And so I got a same day passport the very next day, leaned in and started, and I went there and taught this course in Korea. My first time leaving the country, took my flight, you know, from DC to Atlanta and then a direct flight to Seoul, Korea, had to get on a high speed train 2 hours south. And every night I was studying what I had to teach the next day. And I did that for 5 days and, taught the course. I was very happy with it, was very proud.
And you know what you did? You know what you did? If a person sits back and looks through the window at that conversation, you raised your hand.
Correct. And I will tell you, if I look at my career, that's my secret weapon has been, I believe in myself and I'm not afraid to raise my hand. And I will tell you the cool part of that story is I flew home on Friday, landed on Saturday. I came into the office on Tuesday of that week. And when I came in, my boss came to me and said, hey, Brian, look at this government letter that we had got. And it pretty much said, Brian, it was to my boss, Bruce. And they're like, the course that just got taught, if Brian is willing to teach it again, we'll move it from one course a month to four courses a month, because the people that were there in Korea, and these were all active duty military, had never felt more seen and more understood than that course. And I can tell you that day I got promoted three levels above where I was when I was at the help desk. And within a year, I was able to bring on a team that ended up being 140 employees that directly reported to me. The boss that originally hired me at that role as a help desk became someone that worked for me. And we started redesigning my role. We started growing this massive team. And it's, to me, wild, right? Because it was simply raising my hand. But the interesting element of that, to kind of tie it back into the conversation on the mental health transparency, was I think we all have to like look at where it shows up, because I had the highest civilian clearance you could get. I had a top secret SCI clearance with a polygraph. So I understand privacy. I understand security. I understand regulation, regulated industries. And I'm a believer that we have to start re-examining some of the things that we don't talk about, some of the things that we kind of layer in. But like the big piece of one of the talks that I give is really understanding that being transparent doesn't guarantee trust. Transparency gives people a window to decide if you are trustworthy. And I think in ADHD and mental health conversations, we have to really understand that and understand that role. And so, I think having the conversations within your organization depends on your job, where you're at, the things that are going on. But I believe the more you can surround yourself with people that you're willing to be more open with, the more the conversation changes. My business partners, my clients know that at 2:40 p.m. every single day is my alarm goes off because I have to take my Adderall and I am medicated for my ADHD, and my daughters know it. And part of that for me was accountability, because I oftentimes forget to take my medicine. But it was also changes the narrative whenever they start to understand how I work, what I work best on. And that's been the lesson for me over the years. Was I think I was jaded a little bit when I was diagnosed, mm-hmm. that I wanted everyone to come to me and understand how to work with me. And I realized that it's about meeting in the middle, right? It's about embracing what we have as neurodiverse, but also helping to educate neurotypicals so that we can meet in the middle and best work together. And so I think for anyone that's out there, to me, that's how we move forward. It's not about forcing people to think like us. It's not about us trying to, do what we did for many years, especially, for me, 31 years of trying to fit my, square peg in their round hole. It's about like kind of redesigning that hole so we can both kind of work together in between.
Okay. So I got a role play for you. Yeah. Okay. So let's role play this. And let's talk to some business owners first, because I've got more questions around focusing. But let's say I own a business,
yep.
and I've got 100 employees or whatever. I've got one employee that is, let's say you're in, I'm not going to give you IT because that's just too comfortable. Mm-hmm. So let's say that you're working in customer service.
Okay.
All right. You're not happy. You're not, you're that younger generation, and you're leaving. I mean, you've got your bags packed, you're ready to go. How do you go to me as your boss and have that conversation? Could you, so basically I'd open it up and I'd say, so Brian, you wanted to talk to me today about your job.
So, yeah. So I think part of this conversation comes down to, let's face it, especially for this is a lot what I get hired to do on how do we position things that we want to change, right? Just telling people we want to change or we want something to change has never worked. It's not going to work, right? No one wants to change. No one wants a new app. No one wants a new technology. If you go in and tell your boss, I want to do Instagram lives for our company, they're like, we can't even handle what we're doing. But I that's just how we all work. But if I go in there and tell you, hey, do we want to shrink the distance between our audience and start to better understand those that are already following us so that we can really shift our narrative around turning our current followers into super fans? Would you like me to build something on that? Of course, a boss is going to be like, yes, please.
Well, no. Okay. So my response would be like, that sounds great, Brian, but we haven't got the infrastructure right now or the funding to do that. Maybe in the future, we'll keep you in mind for that.
Okay. And I would say, that's great. And if you don't mind, I'm going to take a little bit of my time and I'm going to demonstrate, I'm going to kind of prove a concept. And can I come back to you in a week after I do a couple of things and bring you kind of an example of what I'm talking about?
Sure. I'd be open to that. That would be great. And that's all it takes right there.
Yes.
But it takes two parts. It takes a business owner that's open
for sure
to listening to their employees' ideas and their contractors' ideas. And it takes the employee to take the extra initiative,
yes.
right, to make it happen. And if anyone saw that or listened to that, I would really go back and listen to it again, because you did a great job right. on that. And you got the pushback. Right. I said, no, we're like, hey, that sounds great, but you're right. We can't handle what we have. So that's awesome. Thank you so much for that. So, all right, next, I wanted to ask you about speaking.
Yes.
I do a lot of speaking myself. Everybody has their own methodology on how they prepare, how they go up. Talk to us about, let's say you may be in the US. Let's just take you're in the US.
Yep.
You're going to be speaking to, a large audience, but you're not on. You don't have game on. It's just one of those days.
Right.
So you're not focused. You didn't bring your Adderall, but you got to go on.
Right.
How do you, Brian, how do you get focused for that?
Ooh, I like that one a lot. And I actually, as soon as you said, I don't have my Adderall and I wasn't focused, I actually have a talk that I gave back in 2019 that fits that mold. And it was an 8,000 person audience. It was even an industry that I was not fully ingrained in. It was kind of a new industry for me. And so for me, one of the things I will say is, as a speaker now full time, one of the things I started to do early on when 2005 was the first talk I had ever given, and it was to the Joint Chief of Staff at the Pentagon. So General Petraeus, who many know from a lot of the wars and things that were going, was in the front row in full military, it was inside the Pentagon at the time. And I've been very blessed. That was my first kind of opportunity. I got certified in training, because you couldn't speak there if you hadn't gone through the certification. But one of the things that I kind of was taught through this certification was I failed the first two versions of the certification. I failed not talking fast and understanding how to use your language. I talk very fast. The second one was not using your hands or being distracted. And I failed both of those. And on the Friday, I remember feeling like, hey, I failed both of those. I'm going to embrace who I am and how I am. I'm going to deliver the content from where I position myself. And I passed the certification. I remember talking to the person that certified me. And I was like, wait, I failed part one and part two. How do I end up passing? And his comment back was, you understand the impact you are making, and you are setting yourself up and using everything at your disposal to make the impact. And that is the opposite of what, you know, kind of the things we're going to. And so to answer the question on, okay, I'm not focused or I'm distracted. One of the things that I believe is the greatest investment anyone can make today is self-awareness. And there's a difference between being someone that is confident or an extrovert or, I've always been confident. I've always been someone that is comfortable in my own shoes. I'm unapologetically myself since as long as I could remember. But being self-aware means you understand what you do know. You understand what you don't know. You understand where you get your energy from, what takes your energy. You understand where, you know, how you, those things impact your life. And so for me, part of the outfit I wear, so I wear a backwards hat, a t-shirt, and very bright colored shoes on stage. And I've spoken in front of IBM, the US government, Dell, Samsung, SAP, some of the largest events in the world with that outfit, right? And so part of it is like, oh, Brian, like, you know, is it, you know, you're putting on a show, or it's your Steve Jobs version of Steve Jobs, you know, of his mock turtleneck. And for me, interestingly enough,
it's who you are.
It is who I am. But there's also a second aspect to it is, one of the things that's scary, you know, public speaking is the number one fear in the world. And I believe there's two folds of why it's number one fear. First one is, and quickly, is like the idea that because the stage is lifted higher than the audience, there's a false belief that you must be an expert and prove to the audience why you know more than them as a speaker.
You're worthy of being up there.
Right, which is definitely not the case, because as a speaker, your job is that you are sharing a unique perspective that only you have. And your job is to connect your unique perspective and the stories you share to what the audience is actually caring about, right? That's the magic there. And most people have this false belief, like, I'm not the expert. I'm not the smartest person in the room. And I've done, you know, 800 talks in my career, or 800 plus, and I've never been the smartest one in the room. I've never even wanted to lean into that. But the second one that I believe bleeds into this fear of public speaking is that fear of unknown. What are people thinking about me? What are they going to say about me? How are they going to judge me? Where are they going to go? And I realized early on in my career, and this was at the Pentagon, my second year speaking, was when I wanted to speak without a tie. And it was a big deal because everything was suit jacket and tie. And, you know, for me, so much.
And they asked you to do that or no?
They always forced me to have like, hey, this is your dress code. And I would push back and say, well, do you want me to be most comfortable? And then finally I had a boss that said, you know, and the talk that I was giving about, we need to change the way we share online so that millennials know what we do. So the whole idea was, how do we recruit people when the only thing the government says is, you know, this is what we do, but everything's classified, right? It's like almost like, come work for us, but what we do is classified, so you don't get to know. And like, there was like always this disconnect of, why is this generation not wanting to work for the government? And so for me, part of that was this idea of change. And so I convinced my boss to said, I said, hey, I'm not going to wear a tie. And he was like, all right. But he's like, you need to wear a tie like to backstage. And little did he know at the time, I didn't wear the tie. I took the tie off, but I also tucked my backwards hat in the back of my pants underneath my suit jacket. And so I went up to talk about change, and I'm speaking to this entire room of executive leaders for the government about change, reshifting our mindset and not judging things based on what we've heard about social media. And everyone's nodding their head. I'm like, and I kind of paused and I walked kind of to the side, like dead center of the stage. And I was like, we don't want to judge people, right? No one here is judging people on like their looks or what they come on social media. I was like, because don't say things like, thank God Snapchat didn't exist for me in college. Because really what you're saying is, I'm no different than this generation. But unfortunately, this generation has more of a spotlight and more, you know, things are being publicly shared because there's like that misconception. And I pulled my hat out from underneath my jacket. I put my hat on. And the feeling, that moment of the audience with like a kind of like an aha, and then like this like leaning forward and like, wow. And I was like, how different would it have been if I walked out with this hat on to begin with, versus pulling out the hat now that we're kind of shifting the narrative. And the piece for me on that is that you know, with my ADHD, I am a people pleaser. I am without question a people pleaser. I am someone that wants to make everyone happy. I am not apologetic about that. I know it's something that is oftentimes a limitation for me. It's something that has hurt me in many cases, but it's also something that I've learned that it is who I am. And what I also realized was I'm not afraid of someone judging me based on like me knowing what they're saying about me. It's the unknown. So partially when I walk out there with, you know, bright colored pink shoes and a backwards hat, the thing that actually gives me really great comfort is I know that if people that have already known me, they're fans of mine, they're there in the audience. People that have never heard of me, don't know who I am. When they see me, most of the time they're like, oh, another one of those millennial backwards hat. He doesn't even have respect for us to wear a clothing. And the interesting thing is, if I know that that's the baseline of where they're at, I'm comfortable. The problem is when I don't know.
You know, the thing is most of those people probably have young adults that are going through this right now. So they really should embrace that.
The connected back to that piece where you were asking about like, how do I focus, right? So the thing that I connected, so it was twofold. It was, I need to best understand how the audience thinks about me. Even if they think bad about me, I'm okay with that because I'm very confident to know if they give me their time for the whole talk, they're going to go from judging me and unsure and like laughing to a fan and giving a standing ovation. I'm very confident in what I deliver. But the second piece of
Hang on. I want to break that down real quick. Yep. So 5 minutes you're into it and you know, you're not connecting. You're not focused. You're not connecting. So then what do you do?
Well, so the caveat is actually before I take the stage. So like that idea before I ever get on the stage, and maybe I'm not focused. Maybe I'm more nervous than I am. I'm feeling disconnected. My piece of it is I go sit with the audience. I go into the front door where people are walking in, and I shake every person's hand. I ask them, you know, hey, how's it going? My name is Brian. I'm one of the speakers. What are you hoping to get out of this talk? The next person comes, and I fully integrate it, because what it starts to have me do is two. It first allows me to better understand the audience. But here's the part that matters to me the most is I'm someone that does not want to let people down and wants to people please. And if I feel like I know the audience and they're giving me the most valuable thing in the world that no money can buy, which is their time and attention, then I know that I will deliver once it's time. Like I know, like even if I'm not focused, even though I don't have the energy, if I can put someone's name, I can be like, oh my goodness, this person said that the only reason they came to this event was because they heard I was on the lineup. That right there, when it's showtime, there's no question. The lights come on and I'm ready to deliver.
Yeah.
Now I will say,
if you love to speak and you can speak well, I mean, it's awesome. It's a great, I do speaking as well. It's an awesome feeling, you know, when you can really connect with the audience and make a difference,
it's the greatest dopamine hit someone with ADHD could ever have.
There's no
greater dopamine hit than that. And I also think when you believe in what you're able to talk about, right? I feel like that is such an important aspect.
Yeah,
and I will say the other piece of it that you mentioned about like, you know, maybe I feel like I'm disconnected from the audience, you know, in the moment. You know, one of my commitments has always been, you know, what I'm talking about, how I'm talking about, the stories I'm sharing are not for me. Right? I'm not doing them for me. It's the idea of I'm doing it for the audience. And then, so if I feel as though where I'm going is not connecting, I am perfectly comfortable throwing away the plan and adapting from there. And that takes a lot of confidence, a lot of experience, but also just a focus on things that kind of fall out. I did a boot camp with a gentleman, his name is Joe Navarro. He's a retired FBI agent. And it was all about nonverbal cues and body language. And at the time I actually took it because I was playing.
Wow, that's really good.
I was playing semi-professional poker, and part of the semi-professional poker group, we were able to be a part of that. So I played poker. I did the World Series of Poker for 4 years, traveled around the world.
Ryan, is there anything on here that you can't do? Actually, I mean,
That's part of the ADHD, right? The element where I've never believed in everything has to be finding your passion. I believe we can be passionate about everything we're doing in that moment, right? It doesn't have to be our dream job. Each job that I've ever had, I've found ways to become passionate about what I'm doing. And I've also had, you know, a very, I'm one that will lean into things that, you know, I'll try something and lean into what it works. And that, interesting enough, the skill set that I learned at the poker table for a couple of years, and it was after I left the government, I left the government, my security clearance got held up because of one thing that wasn't declassified. So I couldn't get another job. I was getting paid a salary. but I couldn't get another job. And so I was in Arizona at the time, and I had played poker on the weekends. I just started to play it a little bit more full time, ended up getting a sponsor that allowed me to travel, and I won a couple of events. And so then I got to do some more things on that. But I will tell you that training, the nonverbal cube training, the understanding of the human condition. I am not great at math. I'm the worst online poker player you've ever seen. That's a millennial. Like, I'm not good at online poker. Even my sponsor was an online poker company, and they introduced me as the only millennial that sucks online at poker, because I am a person that reads body language. I can have conversations with people, have them get to know me, and they're off their game, right? I can play against the people that I, you know, that kind of shift. And as a speaker on stage, part of what I'm doing is reading the baseline of the audience. And yeah. I will say, for every talk I give within the stories, I have a 5-minute version, a 2-minute version, and a 1-minute version of every story, 5, 2, and 1. And if the audience is all of a sudden like nodding and leaning in on it, I know that I don't need to do the 5-minute, right? Or if they're like, you know, leaning back and they're kind of like feeling like they're glazed, okay, man, I need to lean into my story. So to answer that question, a really long way of doing it, the way I build my presentations today give me a lot of freedom to lean into my skill sets. But because I struggle with focus in many different areas, I also have a structure that every single talk, it's called the Sticky 5 is the name of it, because I put on a sticky note. I've done it for my entire career now. And it's how I do every live video. It's how I do every podcast that I host myself. And it's 5 things that I write down. The first 3 are the 3 takeaways that I want the audience to walk away with. So 1, 2, and 3. And the beauty of that sticky note, having those 3 things, is that if I go down a rabbit hole and all of a sudden I'm talking about something and I get to the end of that, I can go right back to that sticky note and say, oh, where was it? Where was the next point that I want to go? Right. So I call it swim lanes, not rules. Cause if you give me rules or a script, I'm going to fail. It's just doesn't suit me.
Yeah.
But those
yeah.
3 things work. The fourth one is on the bullet points is of the sticky 5 is a story that connects to those 3 things that can really bring things home, that can be memorable. And then the 5th one is something that relates to the audience in a way that disarms them from maybe their opinion of me. Sometimes it's a story about my kids or my parents. I'm very lucky. My mom and dad are my heroes. They have allowed me to become the person that I am. And I'm also such a proud dad that kind of fits in there. And so like those 5 things are what I focus on. When someone says, Brian, what do you, you know, practice before? What do you do in the green room? You know, I spoke in front of 10,000 people last week in Chicago at a large, it's called Apartmentalize was the name of the event. And I was there at the Wintrust Arena, and someone came backstage and we were getting ready to go on there. And that's what I literally had my sticky note and it had my 5 things. And the only thing I'm focusing on is, okay, what is the story I'm opening with? And these are the 5 things I have to remember that are part of my talk. And even my slides are built from a way that my slides are for the most part are very visual, but not very, dialed in. And part of the reason is if I get to a place of a conversation and I don't want to just use what was on the slide, I kind of can go anywhere I want. So oftentimes it's just like a title. It'll say transparency. It'll say community. It'll say future of artificial intelligence, but it won't say future of artificial intelligence, the role of cryptocurrency, blah, 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 because it gives me a little bit more freedom to kind of, if I get to that point and I've already kind of mentioned, you know, cryptocurrency, well, now I don't have to mention it again because it's on a slide, right? And so like building the presentation and building the formula that suits me best has been my magic. And I've gone to 6 different very large speaking groups to kind of help me become better. And part of it was I wanted to know that, hey, this is the way it's worked for me, but it might not be the best. And all 6 of them, by the end, they're like, Brian, the way you're doing it is the way that sits you the best. But like they appreciated that I attempted and you know, I walked through a lot of the practices that they would go through. And so that would be my recommendation to everyone is that just because something works for you, you also have to be willing to understand what works for others. Because I mean, especially with someone with ADHD, when I read an article that says 5 things billionaires do before 6 a.m., the first thing I think of is like, I'm not going to be a billionaire because I'm a night owl. I don't wake up very productive.
So interesting you say that. My son, who's ADHD, and I'm ADHD, but he does his best work at night. And he always says that. He always emphasizes that.
Yes.
So, and I want to ask you about that too. So you mentioned cryptocurrency, and that's like the new hot area that I will be the first to tell you I don't know a whole lot about, but I know that my son does.
Right.
So tell us what you're doing in that. Because that we talked a little bit about that, and I was just so intrigued with what you're doing. Would you mind sharing? Yeah,
no, and it kind of connects a little bit to the transparency side and really a future of technology, right? So the the blockchain is the technology that all of this stuff is living on today. And really what the blockchain is for all intents and purposes is a giant ledger that is decentralized, which means no one entity controls anything. And it allows for security, allows for transparency across the board. Everything is publicly shared. Everything is publicly out there. But what also it does is it doesn't allow or enable certain things to be driven by big business or by the government. So there's a lot of like freedom on there. And so things that are being built on the blockchain, one of them, it's most popular at the moment, is cryptocurrency. And the idea of, we've heard about Bitcoin and Ethereum and a lot of these coins. And really the beauty of this is the idea that a lot of countries, a lot of people, even a lot of jobs, a lot of people's roles today, it's hard for them to get a bank account. Or in many of the countries, they don't have an ATM, or there's not a way to kind of build the security.
We are so fortunate in this country, are we not?
We are, without question. And I think there's also this element of how do we truly become a global society when our exchange of money and goods and everything is not only oftentimes in different currencies, but it's oftentimes has such different regulations that it does not allow in many areas someone that have a booming business, a booming entrepreneurship or small business in, let's say, a company in Djibouti, right? In Djibouti, Africa. And the reason I use that is I have someone that I've been working with recently who's in Djibouti, Africa, and has, an amazing brand and business that he is working on. He is mentoring young females to embrace their confidence, understand their impact on the world. And he's doing this from a small town in Africa. And for him, the opportunity to travel, the opportunity to do things has been very fortunate. But unfortunately, because of regulations in the country, regulations in their business model, even getting a loan, those type of things are so different there than they are a lot of people that are hiring them. It's been really a tough piece of it. And so what really this cryptocurrency is doing is it's giving us a new way to rethink about what is valuable, right? So, and I mean, I won't get into details like the crypto side of like, because the US dollar at one point used to be backed by gold. Now it's not really backed by gold, right? We're printing money.
Right.
The idea is the reason it has value is because we all determined it has value. And that's technically where this cryptocurrency place goes. But for me, the beauty of it is the idea of this transparency and that there's no borders and there is no like one entity that is controlling things. And so for me, this idea of the creator economy has emerged. And part of it is, I mentioned before, I've been very fortunate for 7 years now to make a living off of influencer marketing. It's one of the three pillars of our business. And what is beauty about that is I work with brands of all sizes that come to me and say, I work with the Super Bowl. I work with really cool companies from Yahoo and the MGM Grand Hotels. They'll come to me and say, Brian, we want to work with you because the audience that you have trusts you. And we believe that our brand, it would be great for that audience, but that audience doesn't trust us or doesn't know who we are. So we're going to work with you, the influencer, to bridge that trust. And that's kind of how I always sell it and position it. But the entity of it is the brand hires me, I get paid, and then I go to my audience and either, I'm talking about a product or a service, or I'm letting them in on something. But the essence of that is still me as the influencer is the only one being rewarded, even though I have a very loyal, amazing fan base that will jump and take care of what I'm doing. In this new space, this creator economy, the idea is, it's very much the quote of the rising tide leads all ships. And so if you think about it, I'll put it in the premise. So I have a coin, a creator coin, and the creator coin is ADHD is the name of the creator coin.
Oh, and repeat that. I'm so excited for you. Tell it again.
So I was presented this idea to have a creator coin on the Ethereum sidechain, which is by a company called Rally.io. And they came to me and said, okay, we want to work with you. You need to have a 3 to 5 letter name of your coin. And my last name is Fanzo, so it could have been very easy for me to use Fanzo. The name Speak, because I'm a speaker, S-P-E-A-K, would have worked perfectly as the name. But it was really a no-brainer for me naming my coin ADHD. And I refer to it as a superpowered coin. So it's not just for those that have ADHD, but for me, it's, I know that ADHD has become my superpower because of how I approach it and lean into things. And so I named it ADHD back in February of this year. And it's been amazing. The coin and the impact it's made. We now have over 500 coin holders total that are crazy, investing and holding it. And we have some really cool things that are coming around it. But what is really neat about this, and I think of this the mindset that I want to look at this creator economy. Like I'm a big Dave Matthews Band fan, diehard Dave Matthews Band fan. I joined the Warehouse Dave Matthews Band fan club back in 2004. I was one of the first 500 members that joined it. I've seen him well over 70 times in concert. My ex-wife, the mother of my kids, has seen him over 90 times in concert. And so I joined that fan club back then. And part of the fan club is you get early access to tickets. But this was also before, I would say, Dave Matthews was as big as Dave Matthews is and travels the world. And for me, as a fan club member that was an early, adopter and fan of the band, it's been great to get early access. But I haven't risen or been rewarded or came along the journey with Dave Matthews as he's become successful, right? And so in the world that it's always been, it was more of like, hey, thank you. These are my super fans. This is your passive revenue. In today's day and world, the idea is shifting. And the idea is really shifting towards this idea that says, if you are investing in me and you're part of this, not only mm-hmm. if I would have joined Dave Matthews Band, I would have said, hey, I'm part of this. I get this exclusive access. And as I increase the value of the band, as the creator increases, so does the coins that I'm holding as an early investor. And so for those investing in my coin back when we launched back in April, it was worth $1.40 was like the total coin value. And so people that were investing in it, it fluctuates. So no, I'm not giving financial advice, but at the moment, this morning when I woke up, it was $5.74 is what the coin
was. Awesome. Right?
So five times that piece. But also beyond just the idea of the financial element of this is that those that are holding my coin get private access to a Discord server where I give free content, free access to me. We do live streams in there. I give them access to all the things behind the scene. We're doing a merchandise rollout where everyone who holds the coin gets access to a superpowered, the branding is superpowered, access to this merchandise. And so interestingly enough, the reason I'm most excited about this idea is it's no longer about getting millions of followers or no longer about having to have a brand that everyone knows about. It's actually going back to this, and I really recommend everyone to check out this. There's a essay that was written back in 2008 called The 1,000 True Fan Model. So if you just Google 1,000 True Fans, is the first article that comes up. And to me, it is the most beautiful mindset of how we need to reapproach social, digital, even our business as a whole. And the essence of it is, rather than trying to get more followers, more leads, more people, more, it's kind of the world we live in. Rather than doing that, what if we built 100, 200, 300 of people that are that loyal to us, they understand what we're about, and we invest more into them, right? And the idea is you don't end up having to market or sell because you're investing in the people that truly love you. They become the ones that market and sell for you. They become the ones that are talking about you. And then on top of that, because of this creator economy, because of the cryptocurrency concept, as we grow, we all grow together, right? And I will tell you, back in June, I got a message from a gentleman, and his name's Kevin. And he said, Brian, I followed you on Twitter. I didn't really know anything about cryptocurrency, but you've never steered me wrong. He's like, so, I took $1,000 back in April, whenever you kind of mentioned that you were doing the ADHD superpowered coin. And he's like, I threw it in there. And, and part of this also, every week that you're holding the coin, the company that I work with actually gives you rewards. So whatever percentage of the coin you're holding, you get rewards that are automatically deposited. So even not even doing anything with the coin, you can hold it for 3 months, get rewards. And so in June, he took out $10,000 to put a down payment on a new car. And he told me, he's like, Brian, I literally just took a chance on some guy I was following on Twitter. And he's like, and you've been replying to
me. It's a different world now, isn't it?
And it was, to me, so I believe I'm an optimist. I'm a believer in the power of social to lift great people up that are doing great things. And I'm a big believer in if I'm built, I have, 500,000 followers across social as a whole. If I'm not using that influence to make the world a better place, to make it an impact others, I've wasted all of this time.
It's what it's all about.
It is. And when I got that email, and this was someone that he's a very successful business person. So it wasn't like someone but his comment to me was like, I just trusted someone that I followed on Twitter. And he's like, that $1,000 investment was worth it within the first month of what you gave me on the Discord server in the back end. He's like, but then the fact that not in my budget, not in my plans was to get a new car. And then I realized that I could take out my rewards and the wins that I had investing in your economy and purchase a car without having to think. And to me, that's where we're moving towards. So it doesn't matter if you're a cook, I believe that you're going to see places where people are going to invest so that you can spend more time cooking and less time selling your recipe book or less time selling recipes. If you are a teacher, the mother of my kids is a teacher. I'm a huge believer in teachers. I believe they are they're the ones that are not only shaping the future, but we have to
empower them. Influence us. You can usually ask somebody that there's a teacher that said something that either hurt them or inspired them. So they are so important.
They are.
And we don't look at that.
And I believe there are so many great teachers in the world, but there's also a lot of teachers that haven't had the opportunity to maybe lean in. And, you know, things like great, syllabus, teachers that have put together great programs. What if they were able to have a community online where someone was able to, a school system could invest in whoever wins Time Magazine Teacher of the Year? It's not just about getting them on a magazine and putting them on a pedestal, but it's about giving the US or the teachers around the world access to their syllabus, access to their content. But also by giving that access, that teacher still gets rewarded, right? The teacher's still making money off of. And so together that teacher's rising and all the teachers around us are rising. And so I really believe it's going to shift. We're going to move from, we had kind of the internet revolution. And then we had this idea of the attention economy where people were really just monetizing the attention that we had with, everything from ads on YouTube to all of that side. We're now moving into this idea of the creator economy. And it's really exciting in my opinion, because if you love what you do and you are doing great things that impact others that people believe in, you can really start to re-examine and really even rethink the jobs that you've had. And I have 11, 9, and 11, 10, and 8-year-old daughters. When I talk to them about what do they want to do when they grow up or how we're like shifting things, the conversation is such different now, because it's not about what one role or what job do you have? Because let's face it, there's app developers on the Apple App Store that 10 years ago, that entire industry didn't exist. And now it's 100 million jobs that exist in that space.
And it all starts from a great idea.
It does.
Right. So I love that. Well, listen, I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. So first of all, I'd love to have you back on a couple of topics, but I have two big questions for you. All right. So first of all, actually, I'm going to make it three. Who inspires you?
Who inspires me? My daughters inspire me. My daughters, everything from watching them interact with a device, watching them talk about people without the thought of race or sexual orientation or religion or belief. My daughter, my oldest, is doing travel soccer yesterday, and I asked her about her new coach that she just second practice, and she's like, "Daddy, this coach loves us." And I was like, "What?" And she's like, he yells, he's very fired up, but he's doing it because he wants us to get better." And hearing my 11-year-old see
such a key model for them, right? Yeah.
And so that inspires me to also remind myself to not only sometimes think like a kid, but also remember that there is an element of all of us that we end up becoming either biased or, kind of stereotyped or kind of put into an area. And there's sometimes that if we take back and look at things through those kids' eyes, there can be magic. So yeah, my kids definitely inspire.
Yeah, and you just have to change the way you're thinking.
Yep.
You have to be open and you've got to change the way. And I've had to learn that the hard way myself.
And I also think you have to be willing to learn and listen from those above you, those next to you, and those below you, right? I think we oftentimes hear who are the people that are inspiring you or motivating you? And oftentimes it's someone that is at a place that I want to be. And I'm perfectly okay with that being the spot. But we also have to be willing to look. I will tell you, one of the most successful projects I ever ran was a helping a company, an app company, design an interface that allowed their people to better use their tool. And what happened was I gave it to my daughters. And all I did was watch them and record video of where they put their fingers, how their first impression was. And I went back to the company and said, "You know what? When my daughter holds the device with a smaller hand and where she puts her thumb and how she interacts with it, your tool base right now will never work. It will not work for someone that looks at technology that way. And she's born on a device." And they switched their interface before they even released the app. They were purchased by another company. And it was simply based on their idea of rethinking the user interface of a tool.
Yeah.
And when they asked me, "Brian, what app? You are such a technology guy. What app did you go find that on?" And I was like, I gave it to my 9-year-old. And I just watched her interact. And so to me, that's that lesson.
That's amazing. Secondly, when you were going to make that change from the government to doing what you do now, what was it that made you say, "I'm going to make the change"?
So that's a good one. So I had just got promoted, and part of the promotion was a month of rewriting the job position, because you had to have a master's and you had to have 10 years experience. I had neither. And I had no plans of ever going back to school, because school was one of the hardest things that I could ever get through. You know, and at the time I wasn't even diagnosed. And we spent all this time reexamining the position, redoing it. And during the ceremony, actually my family was there. They Brian Fanzo, youngest senior VP we've ever had in this role, moving into a new department. He is truly going to revolutionize and be a leader in the cybersecurity space for the rest of his career.
Wow.
And that hit me. It hit me at a very, like in my gut, it hit me in a moment where it was probably the first time I recognized that, like, wait a second, I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. And the other part of it was I had realized over the last 8 months that I became complacent, because I had built an amazing team around me, team that was doing amazing things. But I was also frustrated, because working with the government, they are really good at spinning their wheels and going nowhere, right? It's a very, like, if someone is a
problem, long process.
Yeah.
It's a long process.
And, like, you know, some of the structure, you know, you can't get fired. So if you're a problem and you're a government employee, they're going to promote you out of the way a lot of times, right? And they're going to, you know, there's a lot of that, like, weird hierarchy that exists. And so that complacency, now that I look back, you know, at the time, for me, it was like, hey, this became way too easy. And when things get too easy, I become less motivated, less attached, less focused. And I knew that about me. And I went to my mentors, two of them, and I went to my parents, my wife at the time. And all of them were like, Brian, you have the highest civilian clearance. You've had a job now for 9 years. The contract we were on was moving away. So I was going to have to, like, kind of almost restart with a new contract, but I had just got this promotion. And I had told them that I had to make the decision that if I don't leave now, this will be the job I'll have the rest of my life. And I can tell you, I'd be making more money than I make now, right? Like in a weird
and
way.
And how old were you when you made
this? So I was 9 years. So it was I was 31 years old. So it was the same year I got diagnosed ADHD, interestingly enough.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's awesome. At 31. And so I decided at that time that I put my 2 weeks notice in, and I said, you know,
follow your gut.
I did. And it was scary. I had just, we had just had our second child. So I had a young newborn there. I was blessed. I worked for the government contractor we had a lot of leave that you could build up, and because I traveled so much.
Great.
So I had a mass, I think I had 68 days build up of leave that I was able to kind of, you know, build in after I left. And it was also one of those things that I had told myself, you know, I didn't struggle through college. I didn't work hard to get the job that I was told someone told me that I should have or be excited about. I, in my head, always believed if I don't chase this idea of being a technology evangelist, which was that job that I saw with Guy Kawasaki, then I was going to regret that. And I'm not a big believer in having regrets. And so I didn't know what job would hire me. And I can tell you, I could, for a while, I couldn't find anyone that would hire me in that role, because I would either be overqualified or they would say, well, you're a government person in cyber and you want to do this role. And I was very blessed. I found a CEO via LinkedIn. I found a boss found someone that he, like, interviewed me, and he's like, you're too overqualified, but, like, our CEO is interested. And I was like, well, here's the deal. I am overqualified the role that you have. I was like, but I'm willing to put in all of the work and not ask for anything more. But what I'm asking is, in the first six months, if I achieve all the things that you're asking for, I would love the opportunity to have the job that I've always dreamed of having. And I had the job laid out. Like, this is what I want. This is how I'd want to do it. And I remember I met with the CEO. His name is George Schlesman, one of the smartest guys I've ever met in my entire life. And he just, like, laughed at me. He's like, you do what you say you can do. That job is yours. Make it happen.
You certainly have the confidence. And I would say anyone that listens to this, listen to it twice, because you really do a great job in that.
Well,
so
I can thank my parents, because my parents growing up, my dad owned a very successful candy business, and all of our friends assumed the kids would just fall in line and be a part of that business. And my dad from day one always instilled, like, find your path. I'm going to support you.
Oh, yeah.
I'll be there behind you, but I'm not going to make you go anything. He's like, hey, the door's open. You can come into the family business if you would like to.
Same with us. I was raised by entrepreneurs. My parents had businesses for years, and it was the same thing. And they always just said, find your passion, be happy, and go for it.
Yep.
And go for it 100%. Don't just say it, just do it.
Yep.
And I've always had that, you know, background.
And that's where my confidence comes from. So, like, that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Parenting is just so key. So if you've got great parents, you know, appreciate them.
Yep,
if you're a young adult. Lastly, okay, this is one of our most favorite questions. So I hope you're ready for this.
I'm ready.
All right. So you're getting in your car and you're going to that meeting, but you're not focused, and you got to get game on. You've got to get pumped up. You've got to get serious. You got to get focused. And what is the music or the song or the genre that you listen to in your car on the way?
Ooh, okay. So I love all genres of music. I would say I'm a music whore for the most part. If we use that, like, cause I'm not musically talented. I cannot play an instrument. I cannot sing. And I have like this beautiful appreciation for all creative genres.
It can bring you up. It can bring you down. It can get you focused.
And I love music as a whole. Right? I'm a big fan of music. And so interestingly enough, I would probably in that moment, I believe it would probably be, and this is kind of the funny, it would be an Eminem song. First,
love it.
The first song would be Eminem, and the second song would be Taylor Swift. I'm a big Swiftie fan, and I love the lyrics and the place that she takes you on a story. And I love Eminem for the heart, the passion, and the dedication. And so those would be the two songs. I would go Eminem to Taylor Swift, which is about as polar opposite as you could get in many genres. But that would be the songs that would get me focused.
Like I said, this is such a pleasure, Brian, on so many levels. I feel like we've gotten to know you, and I feel like we've gotten so much great advice for business owners and for young millennials. And so thank you so much taking the time to be on our podcast. And I can't wait for people to hear this. I know they're going to be inspired. I know they're going to get ideas. And so again, thank you for sharing this with us.
Well, thank you for having me so much. I'll definitely be back for sure.
Okay. Today's podcast is sponsored by PeopleKeep. PeopleKeep is the number one rated HRA administration software for small to medium-sized organizations. Thousands of employers trust PeopleKeep to help them reimburse employees tax-free for healthcare expenses, empowering employees to choose the products and services that they actually want. All you have to do is visit peoplekeep.com/refocus, and you can schedule a call with a personalized benefits advisor today.